Ray versus the International Paper Company. Mr. Murphy. Good to see you, Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Brian Murphy. I have the honor of representing Tamika Ray before you. Also with me this morning, who will be addressing the court, is Mr. Paul Ramshaw from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Your Honors, this is a case about repeated, reported, and corroborated sexual harassment and retaliation. There were two claims, one for sexual harassment and one for retaliation.
The problem is that when she told him about it the first time, she told him, and this happens all the time in employment contexts, I don't want to cause any trouble, I'm just reporting this, don't do anything about it. And that doesn't trigger the obligation of the employer to stop it, does it?
Your Honor, I think that would depend on the circumstance, but that comment was just made as to the first time. The record is replete with other instances where she complained after that.
I mean, the record's a mess in this case, and as near as I can tell, she went to Israel and Owens and Smith after 10 years of putting up with this and told them not to say anything. Then she went to at least Owens and Smith again and complained, but the record doesn't say whether she said keep this under wraps or not, does it?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor.
And then finally she goes and tells somebody from HR, and the HR department hopped on things pretty quickly, relatively quickly. They sent some people down to interview McDowell and check out this business about him saying improper things and so forth, didn't they?
You know, first of all, Your Honor, that wasn't the final. And second of all, hopped on. It's an interesting term because what they did was they corroborated and then ignored the corroboration.
Well, they may not have addressed it promptly, but didn't they go down and interview McDowell and other people as soon as she complained to the HR folks? That was in September of 14.
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor, and that's what they did was critical to our case.
And they went and they talked to – Reeves and Hyatt went down and talked to three folks and reported that McDowell told them – the other three employers confirmed that McDowell told them he wanted to have sex with Ray. And they didn't take action against him. But should he be – she be able to recover for all the harassment that occurred up to that point?
It's clear she should be able to recover for the harassment that was occurring during the time that she was reporting to her supervisor. Under their policy, Your Honor, once her supervisor – she goes to the supervisor and informs them of the sex harassment – they are obligated under the policy, and I would submit by law, to take that to the appropriate management and have it acted upon. Now, I understand the point with when she tells them, and I think you made an astute observation, that this is very common in these circumstances, because it is. I deal with this a lot. Victims are often very nervous and worried about what's going
They're
to happen
intimidated.
To them. They're intimidated, and for good reason. In this case, when he found out, he brought her in one-on-one and threatened her. So, yes, she's intimidated. She has very good reason to be intimidated. And then when she did complain to the point that HR came in, they corroborated. We have six different coworkers on the floor who were courageous enough to corroborate what was going on in the September, the November, and the June 2015 complaints. Six different people corroborated it, and they dismissed all that. They determined that McDowell lied to them. They didn't even consider that.
Well, and clearly before she went to HR, somebody had approached McDowell from management, because in the early 2014, McDowell called Ray into his office and said, have you reported me for harassment? You could get me in a peck of trouble. And then sometime right after that, in the spring of 2014, he cuts his overtime.
Correct.
Cuts her overtime, right? Mm-hmm. And the problem, what makes it an unusual case to me, is that the same conduct constitutes retaliation and harassment in some portions of this case.
It can constitute the tangible employment action for purposes of not applying the Elrath-Farragher defense and the adverse employment action, and that's not that uncommon. The standard for tangible employment action and adverse employment action are somewhat different. It's much easier under adverse employment right. action under Burlington Northern, but they can be the same. And the cutting of overtime happens to be one of those when it has a significant the result of a significant decrease in pay. It can be one of those things that can be both.
So what you've got to support the claim of retaliation is that he cuts her overtime, and then at some time in 2014, this is after this event in early 2014 where he asks her whether she has reported him. After that, he cuts her overtime, and then he starts to sabotage her work by fouling up the production line, which I guess it's like a
I can't explain that.
Yeah. Yeah. And he stares at her, whether in a dazed or a lustful way is anybody's guess, but he stares at her, which she doesn't like. And then the question is whether that would be something that would meet the relaxed standard of an action that constitutes retaliation.
I think on the last two, that was the issue. The harassment and sabotage, the district court found that didn't constitute an adverse employment action by citing the Boone versus Gooden case, which we, of course, pointed out has been supplanted by the Burlington Northern as recognized by when the district courts. I don't think there was any dispute that the other form of harassment, the other form of retaliation which occurred earlier, which is the cutting of overtime, that was a different time.
Is that supported by the records?
Yes, sir.
Cutting the overtime?
Yeah. And let me talk about that because they keep briefing that, and the district court bid on that, and they submitted evidence. What we are talking about is daily overtime, the ability to come in 4 hours early for your 12-hour shift.
That's what I want you to do. Explain what you mean by cutting the overtime.
What they pointed to, what we said was in 2014, he cut that daily overtime, which was significant, time and a half.
When in 2014?
About the same time that he confronts her.
About the same time or afterwards?
We don't have absolute.
Well, I thought Judge Gibney set it up for you that it happened after.
Yeah, in early
he met with her.
According to joint appendix.
And you said yes, but now you're backing off. Sequence I'm talking about.
Right.
Was it after he met with her one-on-one? And
you call it the spring of 2014.
It's the best I can do.
But then you say early 2014 is when he called Ray to his office.
Yeah.
So it seems to me the record just doesn't play out. I mean, is the spring of 2014 early 2014 or is it middle 2014? You see what I'm saying? The lack of clarity here.
But in reality, what difference would it make?
It makes a lot of difference if he doesn't know that she's reported him and he cuts her overtime. It might not be a retaliatory action.
It might not be retaliatory.
For retaliation, it's got to be retaliation. It has to be after.
Oh, okay. On the retaliation claim,
right.
You're not on the tangible employment action.
That's what I'm –
okay.
It's kind of a softball question,
okay.
I think.
I would acknowledge that the record does not give us – pinpoint dates on when these. We know it's happened about the same time.
Well, do we view the record at this stage in light most favorable to you?
Well, yes, which would.
Well, looking at it in that light, did the cutting of the overtime happen after he confronted her one-on-one?
Well, I respectfully would say that's not the trigger, Your Honor. It would be
okay. When
he found out, when they tipped
so
him off.
So you're not going to answer my question?
I can't give you a date.
Here's the thing.
You answered some other question.
The case is here before us on a summary judgment motion. Mm-hmm. So we're required, like the district court was, to look at it in the light most favorable to you. And looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to you, can't we conclude that Ray called her into office and confronted her about the harassment and then cut her pay?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
But my...
That's what Judge...
That's exactly. That's what I'm asking you.
Then you win the case.
But the and the point is, when did he know She was complaining. Remember, she's complaining throughout. From 2013 on, she's complaining. Some, they tipped her off at some point. Now, they're not going to tell me when they did that. That's for the jury to determine at what point.
No, but we have to look at the facts now as they appear on the record. Anyway.
You certainly agree that your sexual harassment claim is stronger than your retaliation claim.
Are you speaking in terms of the overtime?
In terms of the precision of the timing.
If you're speaking of the overtime, I would acknowledge that there are other aspects of the retaliation claim, such as the sabotage and the harassment, that you have witnesses saying this is what he's doing. And then you have the lady that was the witness.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about
Nadine.
I'm talking about cutting the overtime.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Murphy.
Thank you.
You've saved some time. Mr. Ramshaw?
Yes, Your Honor.
Paul Ramshaw for the EEOC as amicus on behalf of the plaintiff appellant. Since I'm focusing just on the harassment or the hostile environment claim and not the retaliation claim, I'm not going to follow up on some of the factual questions we just talked about. But it's outrageous, I think, for the defendant, for the appellee, to say in his brief that there's no evidence that she complained between the first time she complained and September 2014, okay? Because if you look at page 514 of the appendix, she says in one paragraph, I made my first complaint to her immediate supervisor and the other two people. And then the next paragraph says, and then I complained repeatedly to my supervisor, told him I had to leave early because of how he was treating me and that he was treating me that way because I wasn't giving him some, okay? And then the following paragraph says, and then in September 2014, I talked with Tuberon and the HR people.
Well, when did she say, well, all right, I know I told you not to confront him about this, but now it's okay to confront him? Because initially she complained and...
There's no evidence that she said that, and I don't think she had to say that. I think you've got an employer with a policy that says there should not be any harassment. This is something we are not going to tolerate, okay? And in fact, the policy itself does not make an exception.
So you're saying irrespective of the fact that she told Owens don't report it, Owens had a duty. Is that your position?
No. No,
it's what is your position?
Our position is that if
the employer's duty,
if at time A,
let me finish the question.
I'm sorry.
As to the supervisor's duty at the time the employee says, don't report it. What's the supervisor's duty at that point?
It depends on the person who gets the complaint should try to figure out how severe the harassment allegedly was and whether other people were possibly subject to it. That would be important in deciding what, and they should ask her, why don't you want us to do anything about it? And here she said, it's because I'm afraid things will get worse. They should be able to assure her, no, things won't get worse. We will watch him.
That just as a matter of law, essentially, your claim is that then the supervisor had a duty to start the process irrespective of her comment.
Depends on the facts. If it's not very severe and no one else is being harmed and her embarrassment it seems to be significant, it's not clear to me that a matter of law they have to ignore her request to keep it quiet. But when she comes back a number of other times and says this is still going on, and she doesn't in those other times, as far as we know, they don't present evidence that in her subsequent complaints between the 1st and September 14, that she kept on saying, don't do anything, don't do anything. Right. At some point, they have to say, wow, okay, they should then say, well, do you still want us to do nothing? Okay? And they should get more and more concerned about the fact that maybe they should do something in spite of her request that they do nothing, because this is continuing.
Well, but don't the cases say that if she tells them to be quiet about it, that doesn't deprive the employer of the Ellerth Fairher defense?
If in cases where there's only one complaint and a request to do nothing, sometimes the employer gets off. So I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. I'm sorry.
I think you answered it.
Okay.
The employer gets off if she tells them not to pursue the complaint, or the employer can still assert the defense, the affirmative defense.
Yeah. Yeah. But if she continues to complain and doesn't continue to say don't do anything,
I think
that makes the balance way different on the let's see it oh, I'm sorry, my time's up. Thank you,
sir. Mr. Coleman.
Good morning. Actually, good afternoon now.
Good to have you here,
Your Honor. Thank you. My name is Walker Coleman on behalf of the appellee here, and I'm here with my colleague Karen Spain, who will not be arguing today. Your Honor, you all hit on a major issue in this case, and I think part of it has to look at how at the evidence that's in the record, and here there is the record evidence shows that there was a one complaint on September 22nd of 2014 of sexual harassment. The record also shows at most that there was one other complaint to Mr. Owens and to others that you all addressed earlier, and that was in 2013, and that is the complaint that Ms. Ray instructed Mr. Owens and others to would not pursue. And under the Brown case, this court has found that is reasonable. Here, almost all of the arguments that are made by the appellee are based on the testimony of Mrs. Ray. Almost all of the arguments that the appellant makes and the EEOC makes in this case are based on an unverified interrogatory responses, and also on her declaration that was submitted after the motion for summary judgment was filed.
Well, that makes her case weak, perhaps, but why doesn't she get a chance to make the case as a matter of fact?
Yeah, and Your Honor, and she does, but if you read carefully those interrogatory responses and the declaration, they aren't clear on when these multiple complaints occurred. Now, what her declaration actually says is that she made complaints over a three-year period, and the record evidence is consistent with that. She did indeed complain after her September 22nd complaint in 2014. She did complain about the staring and the manual loading of the documents, and that was afterwards. But in the record, there's only one other complaint prior to September 22nd, 2014, and that is the one complaint to Mr. Owens and to Ms. Israel, where she instructed them not to pursue it. And Your Honor, if you look at this. From more of a macro standpoint, you had Ms. Ray, who worked there for 10 years. She admitted in her deposition repeatedly that she understood the policy. She understood that there were multiple avenues that she could pursue to complain. And the company even had a 1-800 number and an anonymous hotline that Ms. Ray testified she even used to make an unrelated complaint. So notwithstanding her being fully aware of the policy, she waited for at least 10 years
to complain. Okay, those are jury arguments.
Well, Your Honor,
why is that a reason for us. How would you characterize her legal position? What you're saying is this can't be that strong a case because, look, this lady was here for 10 years. She knew the policy. She didn't do anything. Well, that's all whether the jury wants to believe her, it seems to me.
Sure, Your Honor. With respect to the legal argument, when Ms. Ray finally availed herself after 10 years of the policy, it was investigated by HR. It was investigated almost immediately after she reported it in September of 2014, which was the first complaint that she actually allowed to be investigated. And what was investigated was precisely in the record, precisely what she told them. And as your honors know, in this circuit, the case law under Brown v. Perry as well is the employer is not required to be clairvoyant or omnipotent. They have to be a reasonable investigation. And the record evidence is that she that the HR investigated what she told them. IP actually took remedial measures afterwards, and they basically instructed Mr. McDowell to not have any further contact with her, and they also changed her direct report. And by her own admission, importantly, by her own admission in her deposition, the sexual harassment stopped. It ceased. And so
is that when he called her in, talked to her one-on-one?
No, Your Honor. He called her in before. And I believe the court made a comment about that being a threat. I don't think that he threatened her. He just said, "If you report me, I'm gonna get in trouble." Is all he said.
Well, but doesn't that shows that he knew there had been a report, and then a jury could infer that things that happened to her after that were because of that.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the fact that. That was a report to Mr. McDowell. Ms. Ray knew again of that the policy at IP had multiple avenues through which she could report, harassment, perceived harassment, and she also had the anonymous number that she could have called. And so I believe under the Dowdy and Caldwell cases. I do believe that in light of that, the fact that Mr. McDowell was put on notice as a supervisor of the harassment is not sufficient as a matter of law.
Well, but it shows if he does something to her after that, a jury can infer that it's because of retaliation, right?
Well, Your Honor, if with respect to whether it was retaliatory. If Mr. McDowell took any action after her, then that triggers the analysis of whether or not Ms. Ray can actually establish her prima facie case, and as part of that, she has to be able to show that she suffered some adverse job consequence.
Well, and after that, he cut her overtime. At least that's one way of looking at the record.
Well, Your Honor, under the case law in the circuit, with respect to the overtime being cut. The law in this circuit usually looks to whether the appellant the employee suffered any actual pecuniary loss, and here Ms. Ray testified throughout her deposition that she never suffered any pecuniary loss whatsoever.
No, that's not what the record says. You tried to get her to say that, or somebody tried to get her to say that in deposition, and then she corrected it by following up on that. The record does not say she suffered a pecuniary loss.
Your Honor, and her deposition after repeatedly testifying that she did not suffer any financial loss, any cut in pay, any adverse consequence as a result of her, complaining about harassment or not giving in to his his advances. She then on cross examination, Your Honor, you are correct. She was asked the question and answered the question by her counsel was posed to her. Did that affect your pay? To which she responded, yes, but she did not respond how it affected her pay. And I followed up after that,
well,
and
when
asked her.
When they cut your overtime, it doesn't make your pay go up.
But Your Honor, the actual what's in the record evidence are her pay records, which actually showed that she earned more overtime after she complained.
Right, but there were two categories of overtime shown by the record. There was voluntary overtime in the morning, and there was also mandatory overtime. And so the argument that she earned more in overtime does not speak to the issue whether she would have made more had she been had the voluntary overtime been continued to be made available to her, does it?
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, I think that just
Well, let's not get into the respect stuff. Tell me, doesn't the record draw a distinction between voluntary and mandatory overtime? And the voluntary overtime was coming in early in the morning, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. There were
okay. So she could have earned plenty of overtime in the afternoon so that the record didn't show that she suffered a diminution of the basket of overtime even when her voluntary overtime was zeroed out, right?
Well, Your Honor, that's
that's not correct.
I do not believe that's correct.
Okay, tell me why.
Yes, Your Honor. So you are correct. There were two ways of earning overtime in the record. There was to come in early before your shift and work voluntary overtime. Then if the subsequent shift worker was not there for whatever reason, called in sick, could not come in, then the company had a policy to work mandatory overtime.
Stay.
Right. And there's record evidence that Ms. Ray refused to work the mandatory overtime. And so this placed the company in a bind because they had no coverage after that. And so that was when the company made the decision. If you can't work the mandatory overtime after a shift, because you have volunteered to come in early and work before your shift, the company can't be placed in that position, which is a legitimate non-discriminatory reason that the company articulated in response to the retaliation claim. And so, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that states that she asked to come in. I don't believe there's anything in the record that states that she asked to come in early and was denied that. And in fact, her pay records show that after complaining, she actually earned more overtime, and that's consistent with her testimony throughout her deposition.
She earned more voluntary overtime as opposed to mandatory?
It does not, and the record is not clear whether or not her earning more overtime, what was voluntary or involuntary.
That's my point. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. So we turn to now. Your Honor, I'd like just to make the point that by looking again, if you look at Ms. Ray's at her deposition testimony, she repeatedly stated, as I mentioned, that she did not suffer any adverse consequences as a result of refusing his advances or reporting the harassment. And so I do think there's nothing in the record that shows that Ms. Ray suffered any tangible employment action. Therefore, that the company gets the benefit of the affirmative defense. And under prong one, I think that the company easily meets that. Because it had a policy in place, which offered multiple avenues in which to report the harassment, even a 1-800 number, and Ms. Ray, when she finally when she adhered to the policy, followed it, and made her complaint. It was promptly investigated. The company took remedial measures, and by her own admission, the sexual harassment stopped. So I think on the record evidence that prong one is met. I think with respect to prong two, I think the case law is clear on this, that if an employee fails to utilize the company's complaint procedure, that normally is sufficient to establish the second prong. In the Ellerth case, it was only a 9-month delay, and in the Mount Via case, it was 4 months. In the McKinnish case, it was 10 months. Here we have at least 10 years, and so I think that the second prong is met. So I do think that the district court got it right on the sexual harassment.
What about the issue of the employer's good faith administration of its policy? If you have evidence that the report that they think McDowell lied, but they didn't take any action against McDowell, and then they ignored the co-workers at corroborating evidence that this man was talking about having sex with this lady to them, wanting to. Is that a problem with the employer's good faith prong of Ellerth-Ferriger? In other words, whether they were in good faith administering it, or does the fact that they simply told him to stay away from her, does that conclusively establish their good faith for purposes of that prong?
I think, Your Honor, for the purpose of that prong, I think the fact that they instructed him to stay away from her and she admitted that the sexual harassment stopped, I think that's sufficient. And finally, Your Honor, with respect to the retaliation claims, the appellant argues that the acts of retaliation are the overtime cut and the staring and the manual pushing of documents on the line. With respect to the overtime cut, there's no way you can screw that was done because of her sex. And so I think that really is addressed under whether or not that was retaliatory. And here, again, as I stated before, her testimony is very, very consistent here that she suffered no pecuniary harm or any other harm as a result of complaining about harassment.
That's not what she said in her deposition. She said in her deposition, page 411 or 12 of the appendix, that she had suffered a loss. I guess it was you questioning her. But you asked her this question. Ask on 411. You say you didn't suffer any, didn't cause you to lose any money. Somebody said that. She says no. You object for whatever reason. You objected to that. And then on the next page, he says, "Well, did that affect your pay?" And she says, "Yes, it did."
But Your Honor, and then if you go beyond that, I asked her again because she said it affected her pay, but she didn't say how it affected it. I mean, it could have increased her pay,
cutting her overtime increased her pay.
We're talking about
that was why I followed up with the question afterwards, and I asked her again about that.
So we construe that in the light most favorable to you?
No, Your Honor.
I thought we construed it in the light was favorable to her,
and Your Honor,
which would mean it would cut her pay.
Well, Your Honor, you absolutely do construe it in the light was favorable to her, but that was why, because that answer was not clear. I followed up right after that, and her answer was no when asked about whether she suffered any pecuniary harm.
Right.
With respect to the staring. What Ms. Ray testified was that she believed that Mr. McDowell was staring at her and described it as dazed, and that's consistent with her prior testimony that Mr. McDowell, one of his jobs was to make sure that the main line carrying these units was operating efficiently and moving smoothly, and Ms. Ray even described that line as being a 2 blocks long. So you could imagine if part of your job is to look down a conveyor belt that is 2 months long, I can understand how a stare might be considered dazed. In her post summary judgment declaration, that term was changed from dazed to ogled, and the law is very clear that that if there's a conflict in testimony, you can't change the prior sworn testimony in a deposition by a subsequent affidavit or declaration. And with respect to what the appellant considers sabotage, which is the manual pushing of boxes, there is no record evidence that either the dazed stare or the manual pushing of boxes was anything more than merely annoying to her. It didn't affect any term of her job or condition of her job, and so I think the law in this circuit is clear on that as well, that doesn't give rise to an adverse consequence, and so Ms. Ray is not able to establish her prima facie case. International Paper gave its legitimate non-discriminatory reason, and there is no evidence in the record that that's false or a pretext, and so therefore I believe that the district court also got it right on the retaliation claim.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ron.
We'll I'm sorry. We've got a rebuttal. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Yeah, Mr. Murphy. I apologize to you.
Sir. I'd like to pick up a couple different issues. One on Judge Keenan's questions about the overtime. The other issue with the overtime was that the numbers that they put into the record – We submit support her claim that her overtime was cut in 2014. What they put in the record was that her overall overtime, which Judge King was correct, has two components, increased in 2015 over 2014. I would suggest to you that shows it was lowered in 2014, which is what we said. So it does not show that her overtime was not cut in 2014. In fact, their numbers would support. They never put into the record anything to refute her claim that her daily overtime was cut. That's not in the record. Now, you think that would happen, they would have put that in. I would like to address...
Do you think she gets compensated for the 10 years she didn't complain about this fellow's...
Yeah, I'm not sure she can go to the jury and say, give me compensatory damages for that 10 years.
Does she get to go?
That wasn't an issue we had addressed. I think I could say cleanly here without more research on that from the time she was complaining forward, I don't know the legal answer.
So that's 2013, sometime in 2013?
I believe so, Your Honor, but I don't know. I honestly don't know. That wasn't an issue. The scope of relief was not an issue we addressed on summary judgment. I would like to address Brown, if I could, for one moment.
What's the overtime rate?
That we put that in the briefing, Your Honor. I think it was
I think it's
$24 an hour.
Pardon?
I believe $24 an hour.
Is that time and a half?
That's a time and a half, sir.
So the regular rate, $16 an hour?
I believe that's correct.
All right.
I believe that's correct. This case is a very interesting contrast to Brown. I mean, you think about what happened in Brown. That was there was two incidents. They were on travel trips when Ms. Brown first complained and said she didn't want anything done, her supervisor said, look, I support you 100%. Whatever you want to do, we're here to back you. Now, that was the impetus for this court's understandable recognition that when the employer does what you expect them to do under Title VII, then the employer can have the defense. And in most cases, that is what happens out there today. Most employers do act like that. This is nothing like Brown. The second time that the lady in Brown complained, they reached an agreement with her. They sat down and met with her. There was serious action taken. There was no action taken in this case. The plaintiff actually had agreed with the measures that the employer took. That employer's actions understandably led to the result in Brown. But Brown doesn't create a doctrine for every case saying that because one fact in Brown happened in every other case where that one fact exists, you have to read Brown for the entirety of what happened in that case. And as this court held, it did an exemplary job of reassuring the accuser, taking whatever action was requested and what action was agreed upon. Here they claim they told him to stay away from her. Well, that's a big problem for them because they know he didn't. They know from the, not just from my client's testimony, which is enough for summary judgment, but all the witnesses said he was coming around her. He was coming around her for no reason. In fact, Nadine Brown said it got worse after the September 14 complaint. Every time my client complained, her life got worse. And that's why I'm here. This employer can't avail itself of any defense. And even if it did, it would be a mockery of the defense to find on these facts that this employer, as a matter of law, has met it. Because if this employer has met the Ellerth-Ferger defense as a matter of law, then Title VII's over. Because it'd be hard, you'd be hard-pressed to find a set of facts where the employer doesn't meet it. Also, Your Honor, it is not true that my client suggested that she was not sexually harassed after September 2014. In fact, it's undisputed in the record she complained of sexual harassment after September of 2014. She never said she didn't suffer an actual pecuniary loss. She testified, as you pointed out, that cut in overtime pay affected her. But remember, the questions were about the September 2014 report when he asked whether something was done after her. We briefed that. The cutting of overtime was back in the spring. Okay, so she was you're talking about two completely different things. As to the look, well, I see my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy.
Thank you.
We'll come down. We're going to adjourn for the day. Come down and greet counsel.
This honorable court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning. God save the United States and this honorable court.